Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Chew the Fat. This is Chef Craig Hartman. We're in beautiful Charlottesville, Virginia, in the studios of the Charlottesville Radio Group. And remember, Chew the Fat is your place to go to hear the inside scoop, the inside information into really what makes a food artisan tick, what's in their heart, what drives them to do this crazy work that we do, and what they get out of it and how they feel about the work they do. And this is really important because these are the folks that drive our industry. They're the folks that push the envelope and do the work that is really, truly incredible. I admire them, and I know you admire them, so come to Chew the Fat to hear really what is inside the mind of the food artisan. And remember, you can hear us on chewfat.net and the Seaville Podcasting Network. And tonight we have a person a little bit out of the ordinary as a chef. This person is involved in the meat industry, the catering industry, and an artisan. Actually, you know what? I'm going to let him explain everything about what he does. But the main important thing to me is he makes bacon. And, you know, that's enough. I don't even need to say anything else. We have Ben Thompson from the Rock Barn. He is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and an ex-Navy guy. So how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great. What time did you get up today? Did you get up? Are you an early guy?
I am definitely an early guy. I was up at about 4:30.
4:30 in the morning. So this is kind of late for you. What's your bedtime usually?
Oh, 10, 11.
Yeah. So you're not any more like on a line in a restaurant at nighttime?
Not so much. We still, you know, I miss that aspect of life quite a bit. I'm definitely a chef at heart. I get that fix when I do weddings and different things like that, and those end up being marathon days, and we're up until 2 in the morning.
Yeah, those are the 24 hours, so you get of your week in one. Tell me a little bit first about Rock Barn.
Sure. So Rock Barn started, it's really just born out of a big passion to want to represent the local farmers, represent local producers, and we really felt like doing the catering was our venue to do it. Didn't really feel like the right time to open a restaurant just with the way the economy was.
Sure.
We enjoyed the catering aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Really enjoy being able to write custom menus that are personal to each client.
Yeah.
That was a big factor there. We brought on the pork side of the business to help even out the highs and the lows and really just to continue that trek back to the source.
Right.
All the time. So we got to work with some local farmers here that helped, you know, definitely. I worked with Double H Farm for a while just to get more and more practice breaking down pigs and different things like that. And really just constantly learning and never stopping to learn.
Yeah.
Grew the pork business.
Yeah, sure.
To help even out those highs and lows, and now it's just been a nice ride.
So what is the Rock Barn when it comes to an entity? Not really what it does, but is there really a barn made out of rock?
There really is. We're located at Oak Ridge Estate, and we chose a building that had been on the property. It predates the Revolutionary War, and it's actually a rock barn. We knew we wanted a business that was multifaceted,
right?
And this building really represented that for us, just as kind of an iconic structure. It had been a tobacco barn, a beef barn. It had done so many different things, worn so many different hats over its years. And so we just kind of felt like that fit with us.
So did you restore this barn? Is that what happened? Did you?
We haven't restored it yet. You know, that's definitely a dream. Uh-huh. And right now it's really just an iconic, more of a vision thing.
Sure. Sure. I don't know if you've ever been to Silver Oak in Napa, but they have that tower.
I used to live right down the street from them.
Did you? Yeah. That's terrible. That's terrible. You know, you have. I remember the first time I drove in there and I saw the tower. You know, and I always looked at their labels, but when I saw that tower, it hit me where I was, and it really meant something. So I can tell how something like that would give, you know, the vision for people to, you know, come visit and everything. So where, let's ask right now. So you do catering, and you are in the pork business. So first, let's talk about the pork business. You have a facility where you're doing meat cutting, and what kind of things do you do? What do you think sets you apart from other people who are in the meat business in the state?
Sure. I mean, right now, our vision statement with the pork is really to bring back the culture of the pig.
Right.
You know, you go to all these different places in the world, and whether it's Portugal or Spain or Poland or just every country has their own things that they do with the pig. And it's oftentimes mm-hmm. centered around a family holiday. It's centered around neighborhoods getting together to help out with the work. You know, really deep social concepts like that.
Yeah.
And they've got things that are very traditional, you know, things that great grandma made, then grandma mm-hmm. made, then teaches mom and all that kind of stuff. And things that when those people leave, it's what they identify with at home.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in this country, we do have some great historical parts, but we just really want to affirm that.
Right.
And,
sure.
and continue to develop that and to cultivate that in the here and now. So that our kids know these traditions
mm-hmm.
and that we develop our own
right
as well.
So what are you doing with the pork, and what kind of specifications? What I mean is you're in the pork business or you're in the pig business. Do you raise these pigs, or you're buying them from farmers, and do you have a set of standards for these farmers? Is there something that, you know, makes it special?
Sure. So the first thing is that we recognize that we're chefs and butchers, or
right.
chefs by trade, butchers by passion,
mm-hmm.
and farmers are farmers. So we let the farmer be the expert farmer
right.
so that we can be the expert butcher.
Sure.
So we work closely with the farmers, and we kind of have our parameters of what we like. And that has to do with, you know, organic feed. Oftentimes the pigs are not organic in certification just
sure.
because of some of the cost
absolutely.
Effectiveness of getting that certification on mm-hmm. a small scale. So first thing we look at is feed. Genetics are a huge, huge part of it. We really like a predominantly Berkshire line.
Right.
We do like to bring in some of the other varieties like Yorkshire and Old Spots to help with the productivity of those pigs. Oftentimes, with the Berkshire line specifically, if you stay 100% Berkshire, after several generations, you start to get litters of 2 and 3 piglets. And then it's not just a
right.
great business for anybody to be in.
Sure.
So that's where we start, is really with the farmers. And then we're just, you know, we have a lot of allegiance to them, and that we're loyal to them so that we can...
Sure.
Because there's only so much value that they can add to their product.
Mm-hmm. That's
you
true.
Know? They can raise the animal... And at the end of the day, it's a pig.
Right.
And hopefully it's a great one. There's only so many things they can do to it to increase over the value of a commodity pig.
Right, true.
And so we really view our job is apply our craft and represent them well. And whether that craft is creativeness or creativity in our sausages, or whether that craft is our like technical diligence and doing it right every time.
Yeah.
Or whether that craft is finding a new way to get it to you, to the customer.
Sure. Sure. Well, let me ask you this, because this brought up something. You were talking about organic, and then we'll get back to pigs. And I've thought this several times before. I think if a chef knows the farmer and their, you know, really what their passion is and what their standards are, they don't necessarily need to go out and get a certification for organic, because lots of times they're doing much more than what they need to do to be organic, because they're as passionate as you as a chef, but the cost is prohibitive for a small farm. How do they feel about that, the farmers? Have you talked to them about that particular thing? Or
you know, I think that they're grateful to have somebody really committed to come along and be a voice for them.
Yeah, sure.
A lot of times... there's kind of this gap where, you know, a farmer can go to a farmer's market, and there's only so much he can do. There's only so many people he can touch at a farmer's market.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes the farmer is at the mercy of the abattoir or the processing house.
Right.
You know, if the farmer's not also a butcher, he's at the mercy of them and whatever bulk seasoning package they have and whatever guys happen to be on the cutting floor that day and things like that.
Yeah,
so
I have to tell you, back in the 80s and 90s, do you remember those?
I do.
Were you a kid then? Back in the 80s and 90s, when I was a chef, and some
pretty nice places, I would get local people that would say, hey, I'm raising cattle, you know, and they'd have a specific variety, and they would have cut some of it themselves, and it would be not anything remotely visible to me that would go with a cut I knew because of the way they were
right.
cutting. They didn't have any clue, and they were trying at that particular time so hard to, because they really felt good about what they were doing. They didn't want to go to just a large slaughterhouse. They really wanted to do the right thing, but they couldn't figure it out. And then also they had all this leftover because all the chefs wanted, oh, I'd like a tenderloin. I'd like a strip loin. I'd like
right.
the,
we think we can get 800 tenderloin portions out of one cow.
And so, you know, what you're doing now is light years ahead of what I remember as a chef when people first started coming out and farmers started realizing, hey, I have something special here. And so, you know, I think, for me, it's extremely exciting to have someone like you who can go and have these relationships with these farmers, see what they're doing, and for the farmers to be able to take this beautiful product to you and then have you treat it in the way you were saying how in other countries, you know, there's a culture of the pig. I had a chance to spend some time. Actually, I spent a month in Italy last year, and my son lives there, and his town alone, Mestrino. It's not a very special town. It's in between Padova and Vicenza, which both of them mm-hmm. are special, but it's kind of a modern town. But they have their local butcher. And when you go in there, this man is so humble, but loves what he's doing so much. And when you look at how he's handling the product, how they're selling the product, just even to how they wrap a piece of meat when you buy it from them, it's so foreign. And it's funny, you're in a foreign country, things are foreign. Well, for me, right. as a chef, it was foreign. I was almost crying. I was so happy to meet someone like him. And, you know, just thinking in my head, how can we get back to that in the United States where people care? I remember I got some guanciale, mm-hmm. and, you know, he cured it and lightly smoked it. And when he sliced it, you know, they sliced it and put it in a beautiful gold foil with the really thin paper between every slice was layered exactly a quarter inch apart from each other. And then another piece of paper. And then when they folded it, they put a ribbon around it and then a little wax stamp with their, you know, with his logo. And I was blown away for guanciale, which is, the, you right. know, which is the cheek. And I think, you know, here you are, and you're doing the same thing, you know?
Well, and the nice part about that story, too, is that that's at the local deli.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah,
you know, when's
absolutely.
The last time you went into a food line and saw that much care given to your smoked turkey that you bought?
Oh, my God.
You know,
we
on
don't
a Tuesday
talk
night.
About it.
Yeah. You know, and that's really what makes us tick is bringing back some of those things.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and all these things, they don't all have to be luxury items.
That's true.
You know? They don't have to be things that you only buy at you know, the nicest, you know, fine cuisine store or anything like that. They can be things that happen, you know. Know your butcher should really be a lot like, well, know your mechanic.
Yeah, sure.
Or anything like that. One of the things we like to say about our pork is that we know all the hands that have touched it.
Yeah.
And I can tell you all their names.
That's awesome.
You know, and that really means a lot. And that almost, you know, in a lot of ways, that surpasses the organic certification for me. When yeah. I can tell you every single person who's touched that pork along the way and know that not only do I know who it was, but we've got a relationship with them. We've yeah. talked with each of them about each of their steps of the process. Now, the farmer is so important. You know, he's got so much influence over that product. But then you can't forget the abattoir either.
Right.
You know, there's a 15-second window where he can undo all the work of the farmer.
Right.
Or he can end up undoing all the work of the farmer and giving me a product that I can't do anything with.
True.
You know, so it's so important to have those relationships. And so that's why, you know, we you know, I go down and work with the abattoir, you know, every
right.
couple of months, just so that, you know, even so that the guys on the kill floor know me.
Yeah.
So that when my pigs come through, oh yeah, these are Ben's. You know.
Yeah,
and
true.
And that's really, really important for us.
That makes me happy, by the
Good.
Way. Just so you know. Real quick, what as we're staying with the pork right now, what products do you have? How do you categorize them? And for people who have heard of Rock Barn from like wherever you've been selling, and there's a lot of people, probably more people haven't heard. Where can they find your products, and what can they get excited about?
Sure. So one of the platforms or vehicles that we use to get that product to our clients is called PorkShare.
Yeah.
And so that it runs very similar to a vegetable CSA. It's monthly instead of weekly.
Right.
Since right now we have this remarkable thing called refrigeration, we've taken a lot of the seasonality out of pork.
Right.
But we apply seasonality in our preparations.
Right.
And so basically what it is, it's an $80 package. And you get it once a month. There's no commitments, right. So there's no penalties if you don't, if you're going out of town on vacation for a month.
Sure,
you know, you get a discount, I think, on your sixth one, and then the concept you have to buy into as a client is snout to tail.
Right.
You know, we do everything but the squeal, and if you were going to fit with the Rock Barn, you kind of have to fit with that too.
Sure.
It doesn't mean we're going to give you something you don't want to eat or anything like that. It just means that as part of this pork share program, you recognize that you're not going to get a whole bunch of pork chops and pork tenderloins.
Sure.
For your money.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do things. And the remarkable thing is like guanciale, like you were mentioning before.
Right.
That's normally the lowest dollar cut if it's just a raw cut.
Right.
So some of the really most beautiful things come from the cheapest cuts of meats,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things there. We really pride ourselves on the bacon.
Mm-hmm.
We pride ourselves on things that are really Southern inspired.
Sure.
But really applicable. And so with every pork share, you get recipes of how to use the product. And you can build that collection of recipes. We're always receiving pictures from people of what they've done this week with the product, and that's great to share with everybody.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a place where you're sharing those pictures right now?
We do. We have a Facebook page. It's called TRB Butcher.
Okay.
So the parent company that we started out with was the Rock Barn,
uh-huh.
And then we're kind of splitting that off into TRB Butcher. So the Rock Barn will continue to do some of the catering. And then you'll see TRB Butcher at the Seaville Farmers Market, uh-huh. Nellisford Farmers Market.
Cool. Any other places? So if they go to the Seaville Farmers Market or the Nellisford Farmers Market, you'll be there?
Right. And they can always log on to the website at therockbarn.com.
Right.
And get
it's
in touch
a nice
with us
website,
that way.
By the way. I like some of the things on there. We need to talk. You need to help me out. Yeah. Actually, I'm not going to say that because Jacqueline Conlog, she works with us, uh-huh. And she does the website. It's beautiful, but we like some of the things you did, and she agrees. But she does a great job. For the record,
sure.
She also said to say hello.
Oh, great!
And Todd, I've interviewed the chef at Maya, her boyfriend, and I didn't tell him yet that I told Will, your partner, that Todd doesn't want any more pork cheeks, to send them all to me.
That's what Will told me earlier.
Don't tell Todd, for the record. But
I'm glad you brought his name up. That's a great way that, like, for us, it's so much about relationships.
Sure.
So, you know, we're going to be at Maya. I'll go in there and help teach them how to break down a pig.
Nice.
You know, and so Christian, the owner, he was like, oh, I'm surprised that you're going to, you know, teach these guys what you do. Like, that's what you do. Well, that's great, but, you know, he needs to learn too.
You know,
and
what's
it's not
cool.
Just about me. It's
that's
this
really
isn't
awesome.
This isn't a proprietary
thing.
Yeah,
sure.
You know, I as a butcher can only be so many people's butcher.
Yeah.
You know, somebody else has to be butchers for somebody else.
Well, and you know, those chefs, they're not going to break down a pig every day.
Right.
They're going to need things from you because they're not going to only need, you know, two hams, you know, or two loins. They're going to need other stuff. So. But to learn that, because that just makes them more valuable also. And, you know, a really good chef and a good culinary crew under them wants to learn everything.
Right.
And that's kind of a driving force. You know, folks who are listening, if you're going to a restaurant where you have a chef and a staff that is just incredibly turned on by learning everything about food, it's going to be a better place to eat. I mean, it's going to reflect in everything they do.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? So I think that's great. So, back to the pork products, you're doing sausage, you're doing some smoked things. What kind of sausages and things are you smoking?
So our favorite one is probably the andouille.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I really want to bring up to this area. You know, if you go down to New Orleans, you can buy andouille and head cheese and all these different things.
Mm-hmm.
At a roadside, you know, basically it's a pork stand like we would have a vegetable stand or something. You know, so we really like the andouille. There's a lot of different things you can do with it. Everything from just seasoning your gumbo to throwing it on the grill, different things like that.
Yeah.
We like the kielbasa. That's another one of our smoked sausages. It's great because you can take it the sauerkraut route if you want.
Yeah.
And serve it with, you know, roasted mushrooms and sauerkraut. And then you can also take it the barbecue route if you want and really, you know, go a little bit more American with it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things we do there. We really like, we've got this product that has kind of taken a life of its own. And I was at the cutting board one day and we were cutting up these pigs and I was playing around with this piece of fatback that's got this flat meat through it. And a couple other butchers I know cut that piece out and cut it up for fajita meat or whatever. They call it thin meats.
Right, sure.
And I was like, that's all right. Like, it's an okay use. But, you know, at the end of the day, we just put it in the sausage.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was cutting it out and I was like, I wonder what that'd be like cured.
Sure.
So we cured it in our normal bacon cure. Then we smoked it, and it was pretty good, not quite what we wanted, so we adjusted our brine recipe a little bit, got a little bit more neutral on there, so it wasn't so as sweet as the bacon,
right?
And then we rubbed it in Tasso spice on the outside. So now what we have is we have spicy streakling.
Yeah.
So we've brought back a product that, you know, a generation before mine knew as normal.
Yeah.
And now we've made it almost hip. You know, and so we called it spicy streakling at the farmer's market.
Sure.
And then soon enough, a couple of people at the farmer's market, they started nicknaming it man bacon.
Yeah.
So now we call it man bacon. So it comes, it's thick cut. It's about a quarter inch thick.
Yeah.
It's got a really spicy Cajun Tasso spice on the outside. It's got a nice amount of fat, and then it's got a streak of lean right through it. And that's really what makes me happy with the pork pox is as they take on a life of their own. Because that's really what they are. It's not about me forcing the pig into my box and labeling it as such and asking people to buy it. It's really about, well, let's see what this has to offer.
Yeah, that is unbelievable. Let me ask you then. So you get your pork business and you got your catering business. What do you guys do? So you're a custom caterer. Is that what you'd call yourself?
We are. When we cater, everything is very much, it's about an interview with a client first.
Sure.
It's about what does food mean to this client, things like that. And so the menus are all written just for them. It's not an out-of-the-box catering.
Right.
You know, we do have, through TRB Butcher, there's some barbecue catering that's available that's relatively defined. We'll stay south of Charlottesville just so we don't compete with you.
No, it's fine.
And then, but as far as the higher-end catering, it's very, very custom. It's very specific to the client. And it's much more, you know, we've been described as we're more of a mobile restaurant than as a caterer.
Nice.
We don't show up with insulated containers of food. We show up with a big truck and we unpack a kitchen and we bring that experience to you.
Awesome. And how's that business going?
We love it. You know, it's great. We've had great response this year, enough to where we're really starting to fine-tune and really choose. And it's really allowing us to now really decide who we want to be and really define and narrow in on what that is. And so that's been very good. It's been a learning experience, that's for sure.
What do you think has been your biggest challenge in the catering, in starting a catering business in Virginia? I know that you're located in Nelson, right?
We're located in Nelson, and for the most part, it's a challenging business, I tell you what.
Yeah.
You know, you can show up to an event and all of a sudden there's no electricity.
Yeah.
You know, I spent some time on a submarine, so I was used to dealing with some of those type of things. So that's always a challenge. I think one of the challenges, but also something that we've overcome that's probably been the most rewarding, is watching our front of the house staff develop.
Right.
Because I think in a restaurant, you have 7 chances a week or 5 chances a week or 10 chances a week to develop rapport with those servers and for them to know you as the chef and know the food and represent you in the dining room. And on the catering side, when what we really want to deliver is this, you know, restaurant-level dining experience, then it's often hard if we're doing 30 events that year, it's very difficult to train those servers to represent me the way I want to be represented or the way the food needs to be represented. And so it's been great to watch that develop. And we have this core group of servers that's really stayed with us and watching them. Sometimes I'll like peek out in the dining room or on the dance floor or whatever and watch the servers interact with the guests.
Right, yeah.
And they really own it and they own the product. And so that's probably been the most rewarding for me and also the most challenging at the beginning was really getting people to own us, to be part of the Rock Barn family and then to communicate that to the guests.
Nice. Do you feel like you're living a dream?
Yeah, like I'm always tired.
You're dreaming a lot. Well, right. let's go to this real quick. Who is Ben Thompson?
Sure. So I was born in Sweden.
Really?
I grew up in Colorado.
Wow.
I think I had one of my first prom dinners at one of your restaurants.
No kidding.
In the Springs.
You went to the Cliff House?
I did go to the Cliff House.
For prom?
For prom.
Where'd you go to high school?
At Liberty High School.
Wow.
In Colorado Springs.
Yeah, I remember the kids coming to prom. Wow.
Right.
Wouldn't have that been something?
So.
Did you steal anything? No,
yeah,
just
I stole
kidding.
A spoon, actually. Yeah. That's a tradition. Every chef yeah. steals a spoon everywhere he goes.
You know, it's not only that, but every prom kid's got to take something, you know? I'm like, watch the kids. Watch them out there.
Right. That's I'll see awesome. If I can find that spoon, actually.
Isn't that something? It's no, a small so, world, isn't it?
Yeah. So I really enjoyed growing up in Colorado.
Yeah.
One of the things that I didn't get to experience in Colorado was so much of the really four seasons.
Right.
And some of the deeper culture that even though maybe there's 100 more years of history on this side of the country,
right.
it means something.
Yeah.
So basically.
I'll tell you, when I moved there, I missed the same thing. And it was incredible to me that I could not find a beautiful tomato.
Right.
In Colorado. Right. And it was just, I missed that so much. But there were other things that were, you know, equally as fantastic and beautiful because it is a beautiful state. But I missed that in the seasonality.
Right.
I miss, you know what I actually miss? And people think I'm crazy. I missed humidity because I grew up with humidity. So, you know, when I'd felt, you know, you can almost feel that barometric pressure in the east in some days.
Right.
Like it's almost like someone's hugging you, you know.
Right.
And I miss that of all things. But what I do miss about Colorado, though, is, the mosquitoes. I didn't have very many mosquitoes.
No, so. Not at all.
Yeah.
And I have the reverse. I miss the just absolute dryness. I miss being able to, you know, it's 98 degrees outside and you don't sweat.
Yeah, yeah, true.
You know.
See, I'm different. But see, my father's side of the family is from Puerto Rico and it's hot down there.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I have that. Well, that's awesome. So you grew up in, you were born in Sweden. How soon did your family come here to?
After about, when I was 5 and a half.
Wow.
So
which both sets of parents were Swedish and you just.
They were both American. They were over there. They
okay.
were working in the Soviet Union at the
okay.
time. And so Sweden was a good base for them to work out of.
Right.
And it was interesting because. You know, oftentimes I tell people I was born in Sweden. They say, oh, when'd you move? I say, it was 5 and a half. They're, oh, so you're not, there's nothing about you that's Swedish. And sure, they can make that argument, and it's probably accurate to some
uh-huh.
extent. You know, through the traditions that we kept up as a family, you know, two of my favorite flavors, maybe mm-hmm. even three, are really deep-rooted Swedish flavors that were
yeah.
just kind of ingrained. You know, and through a couple trips back to visit friends and different things like that, and then when I was in the Navy, I got a chance to get back over to that part of the world. You know, it really solidified those things.
Yeah.
And it's great because now they can still come through and,
sure.
and give people a chance to really experience them.
Sure.
So.
Well, I've had a bunch of meals, you know, from Marcus Samuelson, who's uh-huh. actually from Africa, but he grew up in Sweden.
Right, right.
You know, and there's some really great food. Hey, and one other thing, I don't know if they had it. I know the Norwegian soccer team. I spent 6 weeks as a food and beverage director for the Olympic Village, for the soccer village in the 96 Olympics, and the Norwegian soccer team women, they had a tube of bacon called bacon nosht. And every morning they'd pour this bacon. It was like bacon paste, and they'd put it on toast, and they'd eat this thing for breakfast. And I'm thinking, I need to find that.
Right.
It comes bacon in a tube.
Maybe we should make
did
it.
Did you not have that when you were in Sweden?
No, actually, but what we did have was we had this stuff called, it's called Kalle's caviar. And as a young, and it wasn't like, you know, we think of caviar now, it's the finest et cetera with, you know, creme fraiche and toast points or whatever. And this stuff came in a toothpaste tube.
Yeah.
And you kept it in the refrigerator. It was like a metal toothpaste tube. And my parents used to, for whatever reason, I really liked it. And we would spread it on what we call knäckebröd, or it's like a dry, it's like wasa bread.
Yeah.
You know, with this piece of nice Swiss cheese and then this, you know, Kalle's caviar squeezed on top of it. And they used to find me as a little kid, so less than five. Squeezing that stuff into my mouth straight out of the refrigerator.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, my grandchildren are also abroad with my son who works for the Army AFRICOM and his beautiful wife. And, they, you know, they go to an all-Italian school, so they're not going to the school on the post. And they live off post, but they're... they go to the school, and you know, they'll be talking to each other. They'll talk to me, Grandpa, blah, blah, blah. But all of a sudden, as they're talking to each other just in Italian, and it makes me really happy that they're having that experience. So it's probably, I'm sure that there's still a lot of that in you from that period of time, because it, you know, those formative years are huge, you know. So then you ended up, they moved to Colorado Springs. So they were there military?
They were missionaries, actually.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know, that makes sense too for Colorado Springs,
right,
which is a huge area for that. And so you're back there, and you're going to school. Did they love to cook? I mean, where did the cooking thing come from? Because
no, they really didn't. They hated to cook. Mom was really into healthy food.
Uh-huh.
But it tasted terrible. And I've told her, all, like, we've had all this experience.
Is she
so
going to listen to this interview?
And she knows all these things, and she tells the stories. But they tell a story when I was like 6 or 7 years old, and I was complaining about the food. Because you know, the first generation of healthy cooking in this country was like, oh, tofu can be substituted for meat. So slice a piece of tofu, put it on the grill, and then put barbecue sauce on it and feed it to your family. Well, it's not such a good idea. And so I was complaining about it one day, and Mom said, well, you know, Mom was very angry and said, well, you can get up and make your own food then. And so I did.
Yeah.
And then at that point they realized, oh, he's really going to cook for himself, I guess.
Yeah.
So, no, I mean, and I love my mother dearly. She eats a raw diet, which is great for me to cook for her because it's very challenging. And it's humbling at the same time.
Right.
You know, I don't have a chance to use all these fancy techniques I've learned in school or at different restaurants, you know, and so really it forces your
She's
hand.
She's probably extremely healthy, isn't she?
Absolutely.
I'll tell you what, and hats off to her, because, you know, my wife did a raw diet when she was told she had arthritis, and she got healed totally of arthritis. And we try to do it off and on, but I've had a hard time while at the barbecue place. But, you know, making Ramajan you know, sprouting and using that to make Rejuvelac and all that kind of stuff you do. That is you know, someone said one time, raw is not cooking because it's raw. But I tell you, there are some techniques in there that can make that food just incredible. And I think it's fantastic. I looked for raw restaurants in the East Coast. There's hardly any. But, you know, when you go out to California, they're on every block.
Right,
so
right.
I hopefully one day, you know, because I think it's good to eat that way, you know.
And personally, in my life, we really like, you know, my wife and I really like just balance.
Yeah, sure.
You know. We like pulled pork just as much as everybody
else. Yeah, but you can eat, you know, you can eat your bacon raw, you know.
Yeah, you sure can.
Why not, you know? But so this is cool. So you ended up, you didn't cook in high school or anything like that?
I cooked through high school, you know, and the average high school jobs. I was at a deli, and then I worked at Papa John's, and then just one thing led to another, and it became, well, I'll get another job cooking because I can probably make a dollar more an hour than
you didn't
if
work
I
at Primitivo
jobs.
Downtown. Colorado
no,
Springs,
I never got to work at Primitivo. My senior year of high school, I went to work for Dominique Chavanon over at Marigold's.
Yeah, okay.
And
I love those
that
guys.
Was my
I used
first
to go there.
Really inspirational experience. That was that job was when I changed from this is just what I do in high school, but when I grow up, I'll be something else. And then when I started to work for Dominique, then I was like, oh, this guy's different.
Sure.
You know, it was just totally, totally different. And so I worked for him for a while, and he really inspired me to kind of keep going. So he's usually my first stop whenever I go back to Colorado Springs.
Yeah, well, if you ever go back, probably don't remember me. I used to go in there with my wife all the time. We liked going over there. Yeah. It was a great place to go, and a nice drive from Manitou over to there.
Right.
Hey, so you how did you end up going in the Navy then? Was that like just out of high school? Did you go to college first?
Yeah, just out of high school. You know, I was really looking for. I knew I wanted to go to culinary school somehow. Obviously, culinary school is expensive, you know.
Definitely.
And, you know, I have a bit of a patriotic streak in me as well. I was in an Air Force town. We had the Air Force Academy and like five other Air Force bases. So the logical thing was to go to the Navy, you know, and do something different.
Yeah.
I was talking to the Navy recruiter, and they were like, well, you could go do this, this, or this. And, oh, I really want to cook.
Yeah.
And they looked at me like I was kind of an idiot.
So you're probably one of the first people they had just go and want to enlist, but at the same time, cook.
Right, because most of the time, you know, and it kind of, maybe that's part of where our inspiration comes from now. It's like, we really want to bring, you know, honor back to that craft.
Right.
You know, because when I would join the Navy, it was very much about, well, here was your ASVAB score, so you can be a cook or a yeoman or a storekeeper.
Right.
And those were your options.
Sure.
And instead, you know, they told me, well, here's your ASVAB score, you know, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I want to cook. And they said, no, you qualify to do all these other things. I said, no, what I want to do is cook. You know, so finally, once they realized that I was serious, you know, they still couldn't understand me.
But that's awesome.
Then they said, okay, well, you can be, you know, you can do an aircraft carrier or this or that. And one of the guys started talking to me about submarines. And one of the cool aspects about submarines, other than camaraderie,
right,
kind of the fraternity that you join, mm-hmm, in that community, was we got to learn everybody else's jobs. It's like, oh, well, this is great. I can learn how to cook, but I can also learn all these other things. Yeah. So I worked in sonar. I used to drive the boat, worked as a lookout, you know, all those different things.
That's crazy.
And that's really what made the whole experience.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm claustrophobic, so... like, even sitting in this little studio, I get kind of freaky. So,
right.
But, you know, if they close that hatch and, like, we'll come up in 3 months, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, I probably would get over it after about a week of freaking out, you know.
Yeah, but, I don't know. Most people that say they're claustrophobic would never go down, and so you never know.
Yeah, you'd never get them in there to begin with.
If they're going to be all right. You know, one of the most important lessons I took from that was how important the experience of eating is.
Yeah.
Even if it's dehydrated potatoes with dehydrated green onions and rice and all these different things, and, you know, a big block of frozen meat. It's like the crew's only chance to relax was when they came down to the mess decks and had their meal. Because any other time, when they weren't in that 400 square feet of space, they were working, or else work was staring them right in the face if they weren't working.
Yeah.
You know, and so the impact, you know, positive or negative, that you have on somebody's day, either if they're getting off watch and they come down and it's a good meal, they're happy, you know. And then they all come in and give you their thanks, and vice versa. You know, if they get up and you know, they're cranky anyways because they only slept 2 hours, and they get up for their watch, and then they come and eat, and it's a terrible meal, they'll throw their plate at you.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and so you really learn, you know.
There's no way to get away from your customer down there.
Right.
Yeah, they're going to find you.
And there, you're only as good as your last meal.
That's
exactly. So it really puts a lot of pressure on you to really do well.
Yeah,
you know? But you get immediate results.
So what's the environment like when you're down there? Is it like pressurized like an airplane? Do you always have this kind of pressure, or are you?
Yeah, the pressure fluctuates constantly. You know, depending on what depth you're at, the hull compresses, and then depending on what's going on inside the boat, if we're generating gas or we're pumping something overboard, all those different things change the pressure.
Wow.
And you know, there's a couple things that really impact the cooking, but a lot of it's, you know, the angles that you take.
Right.
You know, making cake, you know, you put a cake in the oven, and then a minute after you put it in the oven, they take a 30-degree up angle, and now you've got cake batter all over the place.
You know? That's terrible.
And now you got to figure out how to make the crew happy.
Yeah.
But now your cake is a quarter inch thick and burnt on one end, and it's 3 inches thick and raw on the other side. You know,
Did you have a food processor?
Oh, we definitely had a food processor.
Oh, yeah. I remember one time running out of desserts on a really busy graduation weekend at Cornell, and taking all these little mini cakes and cookies that were left from a reception and putting them in the food processor and folding the cream in with it and some raspberries calling it mousse, you know?
Yeah, we just bake two cakes, and then you put the fat side to the skinny side and the skinny
good
side
call.
To the
they
fat
think
side
it's
and
cool.
Then cover
wow,
the whole thing
that.
And they're like, wow, he made a level cake. I got you fooled.
That's awesome. So then how long did you stay in the Navy?
So I was in the Navy for 5 years.
Wow.
I met my wife Reagan while I was in the Navy, but, you know, really knew that this was a great thing to do at this stage of my life, but I didn't want to do it as a career. You know, really wanted the chance to have a family and be part of that family.
Sure.
You know, as we grew older. So I got out of it after 5 years. And again, you know, I always tell people I would do it again in a heartbeat. You know, and I'd encourage anybody to do it.
Did you go straight to culinary school after that? Was it part of the...
I came here for a while first, and I worked at Oxo Restaurant when John Haywood was still in town.
Sure.
And so that was a great place to work as well.
Did you meet Levi at Oxo? Or?
I did. And the funny thing is I met Levi's mom before I met Levi.
Did you really?
Yeah,
she's a card. I love her.
And then from Oxo, went to New York, went to culinary school, and then got a chance to, you know, through Levi, go to Per Se. And, and really that was just a chance to stage for one day. So I think I was there for like 18 or 19 hours.
Wait, let me ask you a question. You got out of this perked my interest. You got out of the Navy and you ended up in Charlottesville.
My wife her family. It's always about a woman, right?
Yeah.
Especially
okay,
if you're in
I
the Navy.
It. Yeah.
And it's classic, too. She's a nurse. A nurse practitioner now. So, okay. You know, sailor and nurse, they're just supposed to be together.
Yeah.
But, no, she brought me up here. So
okay, that makes sense. Cause I'm trying to think, you know, so you're living in Colorado, you go to the Navy, you get out, you're in Charlottesville. So now I got it. So I think I was brilliant luck for you to hit OXO, honestly.
I think it was,
too. Because I think John Haywood is one of my favorite people ever. I married him, by the way. I performed his wedding ceremony, the wonderful wedding, the wonderful marriage between John and Alice. I performed that wedding ceremony at Clifton Inn.
That's funny.
Nicholas dropped the ring down between the boards at the gazebo, and below that was a 40-foot deep ice pit, and that ring was laying on a piece of wood, and one of our waiters scooped it up with a wire and got it. So that's the John Haywood. But no, I think he's been a great mentor to a lot of young chefs, you know, that are all over the place now. And, you know, his mentality, his passion, and I think, you know, that was a good stroke of luck to hit, there. And so you go to culinary, you spent that time there. How'd you like that?
It was great. You know, I think anybody probably before they go to like a higher institute of learning like that, whatever their trade is or whether it's a regular university, you have certain expectations going into it and certain coming out. And I was really nervous getting in. I was like, oh, wow, I got accepted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, great. And then I got there and then I went through the usual frustration of, wow, who, like, I'm surprised some of these people made it in. You know, just because I was so nervous about it. I expected everybody to be that way.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it was a great experience. Really good to be able to network with those people. And the nice part about that school is it has such diversity and such depth that it's just like any other school. And that, like, you get in, you get out of it what you put into it.
That's true.
So if you just go and expect to just magically come out and you're this great chef, well, you're screwed. You know. But if you go and you really apply yourself and you really say, hey, I'm really interested in learning about hydrocolloids or xanthan gum.
Yeah.
You know, what chef do I talk to? And then you go seek him out. And then he points you to another one. And then he points you to another one.
Yeah.
Or I'm really interested in learning, you know, more about fish butchery. Oh, well, why don't you go spend some time in the fish fabrication kitchen after hours?
Sure.
You know? And there's just a wealth of knowledge in one small area.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I found the same thing. You know, I graduated from there back in 1978.
Wow.
You didn't realize they even
still
had
used
kitchens
back then, right?
Yeah, it was wild. It was a while back. But you know, my favorite things were the things I did outside of class. You know, when I helped the pastry department make all the desserts for the Escoffier room because they didn't have enough students one block or whatever. And, you know, going to the butcher shop and spending time with them or, you know, just waiting tables at a wine dinner or whatever. And, you know, I had people that used to complain, like, you know, I'm not learning anything. And I'm like, well, are you chilling with the chefs? Are you finding out what they need? If they're doing a catering, are you working it with them? You know, I mean, it's the same in your own business, you know, right now. The way you learn is you push yourself. You know, you don't wait for something just to happen. Say, look what I learned. You know, you push yourself to learn new stuff, which is really cool. So you get at, you're in chef school. You take an externship in New York City, huh?
Right.
So I went per se.
Yeah, and it was really a shocking experience for me because, you know, I mean, I grew up in Colorado. I wasn't a big city guy.
Yeah, yeah, true. That
by any stretch of the imagination. And I'd been to, you know,
and you lived
Boston
all these months
the Navy,
in a tube under the water.
With 140 other guys, you know.
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, we were living upstate. So it's like we scraped the piggy bank to get a bus ticket down just to go for a day. At that point, you know, Levi got me in for a day to stage it per se. And it was like, oh, great, I'll have one day to see this place. And I was, the first part of the day, I was just scared.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never been in a kitchen like that. It was antiseptically clean. And there was just like super imposing figures, you know, everywhere you looked, you know, and you were wearing a white apron because you weren't paid. So it was very clear who the paid employees were, who were really legitimate and proven people and who wasn't. And then during so I was very, very, I mean, I think that I'd worked like probably 12 or 14 hours, you know, doing crazy things like sorting watercress leaves to find the perfect ones that didn't have any nicks in them and fit the size parameters that we needed and stuff like that. And then service started, and Jonathan Benno, who was the opening chef there, and he's an imposing character in himself. I mean, he's very tall, and he's a big guy, he's a big bald head, and he said, you know, that's your spot. And he pointed to a tile. It was like a 10-inch by 10-inch tile. Like, so that's where I stood during service, you know. Yeah. But the second the first plates started to be plated at the pass, I was just amazed because all of a sudden it was, you know, it was art culinaire right in front of your eyes.
Right.
And it, this food actually leaving a kitchen that looks better than magazines.
Yeah.
You know, it was the first time I'd seen food in front of me that was like, wow, there's no way you could even capture that in a picture.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and it was perfect every time. You know, and I watched these guys go through this whole evening of, you know, 120 diners, you know, 9 courses minimum for each one, and sometimes up to 25 courses for the VIPs, and just watched this whole machine work. And it was just like, it was absolutely amazing. So I was lucky enough to get to go back and actually do my externship there. So I spent about 4.5 months there, yeah, almost 5 months, you know, and it was grueling. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah.
You know? But I really, you know, I put everything into it because it was my one chance.
Sure.
And it was a absolutely great time.
You know, again, another great stroke of luck, but thanks to was Levi working there at the time?
Levi was. And, yeah, and the funny thing was, you know, I told you I met Levi's mom first.
Sure.
And because I started working at OXXO after Levi left.
Right.
And she was just some lady that had come by, and so I told John this lady came by, and he said, oh, well, that's Levi's mom. And,
yeah,
and John,
sure,
was very proud of Levi because he said, you know, Levi's going to Per Se. I was like, oh, really? Like, that's pretty incredible. And then, and John, you know, he was definitely the type of guy, you know, he was always building bikes for people.
Sure.
And he'd give you the shirt off his back. And so just like he building bikes for people and giving them away, he was like, well, why don't we see if we can get you a stage up there sometime?
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So the funny thing was, is at Per Se, you had to know somebody to get
in. Sure.
And he had to ask a favor of the chef to get this guy in just to stand there and watch for free for a day. So I go there, and mind you, I've never met Levi at this point. I've spoken to him on the phone, but only as a, you know, he did it as a favor to John.
Sure.
And so I was, you know, working there, and people were asking me, like, oh, what's your connection to the restaurant? You know, oh, Levi, you know, Levi was standing at the same table with me.
That's awesome. Hey, so, and then you ended up, when you left chef school, did you go to French Laundry?
Yeah, so I had the option once I left, because at CIA, you know, they do the externship in the middle of your curriculum. And then, so I had the option of going back to the city and working at Per Se, or going out to Napa to work at the laundry.
That's a crazy option.
So, yeah.
Who gets those options?
You know, people who really work hard, I think.
That's what, you know, you had to be doing something right, because if you didn't do something right on your externship, they would have never said hi to you again, you know.
Sure.
And to let, oh, we'll give you an option. That's pretty incredible.
Well, I think it's very important to go in there, and you really have to humble yourself when you go in there. And you have to say,
Were you out there when Thomas had his assistant named Charles Belilis?
No.
Yeah.
Uh-uh.
He's one of my guys. He was 3.5 or 4 years. His assistant.
Okay.
I think Thomas went through a lot of assistants pretty quickly.
Sure, sure.
And I knew when Charles got that job out of Cornell that he was going to make it, because he just had that thing that he could get beat down and pushed and pushed and pushed and not break. And you know, now he's with Michael Mina and getting ready to open his own restaurant. But he tells me about the French Laundry and, you know, having the farm across the street,
and,
you know, all the stuff and the kitchen meetings at night after you've already worked 18 hours and everything. And I would have killed to have had that opportunity in my life back in the day, but we just didn't have. We didn't have those restaurants yet. There were few and far between. Lutèce in New York City, you know, Le Bec Fin, you know, places like that, the Four Seasons, you know, the Joe Baum restaurant group and things. But we didn't have, you know, when I was a young man, these opportunities. But to see what's happened in the United States with the restaurant industry, it's unbelievable. It is really, truly incredible.
Right.
I spending time in Italy and knowing what's happening in Europe and look, Denmark and places like that, United States is killing it, because it's blowing my mind. And so you had a chance to do that. And we're going to wrap it up real quick here, because, you know, we spent quite a bit of time, but, you know, we've learned about Rock Barn and we've seen these things. But so you do your thing at French Laundry. You have all this time where, you know, you're learning from arguably one of the greatest chefs in our time, you know, Thomas Keller. Well, you know, and really his chefs, his chef de cuisines and whatnot are fantastic. Look at the things they've done right. and are doing. But then you end up back in Nelson County.
Yeah, you know, I think we, for one, I didn't go to the French Laundry as like a 21-year-old kid.
Sure.
You know, I'd already, you know, spent 5 years of my life running around the world, you know, and doing different things like that. So we really got to a point where it was, we had to make the decision of, you know, is the goal to be a chef de cuisine of a 3-star restaurant? Or does the goal have the word family in it somewhere?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Or different things like that. And so, and it's nothing against those guys at all. You know, I admire what they do, and I'm still friends with a lot of them. But it really just came down to wanting to guard some personal time and do things like that.
Yeah.
So then, counterintuitively, we opened our own business and had no personal time
whatsoever.
Well,
you know, but still, you can have a family and your family around. I did. You know, back in the day when we started Clifton Inn, my kids would come in, wash dishes, wait tables, help me prep, whatever I needed. And it was a great relationship builder and bonder. So, you know, you're in your own business. You're here. You're doing the Rock Barn, which I think is fantastic. But you bring this wealth with you, which I think is fantastic. You know, if I were hiring a caterer or whatnot, these things would mean a lot to me. And I know there's a lot of people out there that do. And the fact that you're here, you know, in Charlottesville, other chefs, you know, like Melissa and Dean and, you know, the guys over in the Valley, John. And it's just... This is an incredible area. It's just,
it is.
It's unbelievable. So I'm happy to have gotten to know you. Hey, would you say that prom dinner at the Cliff House was probably the thing that propelled you into chefdom?
Absolutely.
There you go. That's what I wanted to hear. Folks, you've been listening to Chew the Fat. Ben Thompson of Rock Barn, you heard it right here. You see what's behind what they're doing in the pork business, which is incredible. You see what he can bring to the table in the catering. Another jewel in the area of Central Virginia. So thanks for listening tonight. Again, you listen to Chew the Fat at chewfat.net or sevillepodcast.com. Give me a ring or send me an email. Tell me what we need to do. Tell me who you want to hear. And that's it. Chew the Fat out.
That it came out as a record, and it was 2 years ago on the record, which means it was like 30 Thanksgivings ago, 30 years ago on Thanksgiving, when my friend and I decided to go up and visit Alice at the restaurant. But Alice didn't used to live in a restaurant. She used to live in the church nearby the restaurant, in the bell tower, with her husband Ray and Facha the dog, and living in the bell tower like that, they used to have a lot of room downstairs where the pews used to be. Seeing as how they took out all of the pews and having all that room, they decided that they didn't have to take out their garbage for a long time. We got up there, found the place was filled with garbage, and we decided it'd be a friendly gesture for us to take the garbage down to the town dump. So we took the half a ton of garbage, put it in the back of a red VW microbus, took shovels and rakes and implements of destruction and headed on toward the town dump. We got there. And there was a sign, a chain across the road, and the sign said, closed on Thanksgiving. We had never heard of a dump closed on Thanksgiving before. And so with tears in our eyes, we drove off into the sunset, looking for another place to put the garbage. We didn't find one. Till we come to a side road, and off of the side of the side road there was a 15-foot cliff, and at the bottom of the cliff there was another pile of garbage. We decided that one big pile'd be better than two little ones, and rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did. Drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep and didn't get up until the next morning, when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of a half a ton of garbage. Just wanted to know if you had any information about it. And I said, yes, sir, Officer Obie. I cannot tell a lie.